Hello, I'm Floyd Maxwell, JustThinkIt.com, doing a Floydcast number 25 for August the 4th, 2014. Begin with the end in mind. Yesterday I was watching NFL Hall of Fame induction ceremonies. I think 7 players were admitted. There's now 287 great players who played their careers in the NFL and then retired. Were considered good enough to be permanently memorialized in a building somewhere. It's kind of a harsh cutoff line, isn't it? If you just almost make it. There's a lot of debate each year about who should be in the Hall of Fame. I know in baseball they debate it endlessly. More than other sports, maybe more than all other sports combined. Partly because baseball is so formulaic. If you get this many hits, you should be in the Hall of Fame. If you get this many strikeouts, you should be in the Hall of Fame. If you steal this many bases, you should be in the Hall of Fame. It's a formula. And the interesting thing this year, baseball has now made it harder to get into the Hall of Fame. Used to be, I think you weren't eligible right away. I think a Mae Young, I guess, takes 5 years, 10 years. And then you start to become eligible. And the way you then proceed is someone has to nominate you. It's a press thing. The media votes on you. Reporter, I guess, of a certain group that you have to be in a group, I forget the name of it, and then you cast a vote. Who's my first pick, who's my second type thing, and I think you get, you know, so many votes. I think it might only be 3. I know for the Heisman, I think it's only 3 votes. You vote one guy is your top pick for the Heisman, and one guy's your second, one guy's your third, and at the end, they'll tell you who got, you know, this guy won the Heisman, and he got, you know, 80% of first place votes. It's kind of meaningful. If you got, you know, 99% of first place votes, it means everybody thought you were number one. If you got 50% of first place votes, it says half the press thought somebody else is better than you. That would... you wouldn't want to get a Heisman, in that case, from a vote that close. So in baseball, they changed it now. It used to be that once you were eligible, you had 15 chances. For the next 15 years, you had a chance to be nominated and you had a chance to be voted in. And then after that 15th year, you will never be put in the Hall of Fame. No matter what happens, that's it, you had your chance. So going into the Hall of Fame, I think a little bit strangely, is time sensitive. You know, if anything, in most sports, players tend to get better over time. So in other words, when you're looking at who's eligible, you don't need to stale date people. You don't need to say, well, you expire in 10 years, because the players are getting better as time goes on. And if they're still thinking about you 50 years later, well, then you should be a candidate, in case they miss somebody, right? In case things change. So with baseball, they'd lowered it now from 15 years to 10. You get 10 chances. Once you're eligible, you get 10 chances to be voted in. Well, the immediate effect of that is you're going to have a lot less people inducted right away in the short term. Over the next 10 years, you might see a reduction in the number who get inducted. It might only be a reduction of 1 or 2. But this is baseball changing. This is the good thing about this, is that baseball began changing. Starting with the steroid era kind of pushed it. Baseball has always done little tweaks. When the game is too defensive, then they do a tweak and then you get more runs are scored. And then with the steroid thing, they started changing stuff. And one thing's for sure is that reporters don't knowingly want to vote into the Hall of Fame someone who did steroids. And that's become a real harsh dividing line. And honestly, a good one. It should be there. That differentiation should be there. And you should have to pay a somewhat ultimate price that you cheated. You did something that no one else was allowed to do. You got away with it. And now you're supposed to go in the Hall of Fame? That's just wrong. Now, admittedly, it's hard to enforce. It's hard to know who used and who didn't. If it's 40 years ago, it's easy. If it's 10 years ago, it's hard. So one of the ways baseball's coping is to shorten the time frame so that you have less chances and they can choose, you might say, their most certain candidates first. And if they mistakenly let someone into the Hall of Fame who were used, well, they're minimizing their losses by decreasing who is going to be eligible and for how long. But the other thing about it, change came into effect this year. Certain players like Mark McGwire was known to be using performance-enhancing drugs, because there's a famous picture of a andro testosterone, whatever the name is, in his locker. some reporter was interviewing him, and there was D'Andro in his locker. And I think this is before baseball had made it illegal. Before they had started testing, maybe? It was amazingly brazen of Mark to have that in his, just sitting in his locker. So then it became illegal, then they started testing, and then they came up with a system where, on the first test, if you are found using a PED, performance-enhancing drug, which can be a variety of drugs, you just lost 50 games. You can't play for 50 games. Think how long that is. Think of one of the impacts is, you keep your body in shape. You get your body in shape, and then you try and keep it in shape. Well, if you're going to go 50 games, which is probably about 2 months, without playing, your teammates are practicing, you're not allowed to. Or you're not allowed to practice with them. You could practice with the kids at the local sand lot, but not the same experience. You're not allowed in the ballpark. You might want to watch, but you can't. You got to watch on TV. These guys might have been your closest friends. Suddenly you ain't hanging around with them for 2 months. It has some pretty substantial repercussions in it, and other even more serious ones, right? Your pay. I don't think they're allowed to pay you for those 50 games. So baseball has a good graduated response. After that first offense, the second one, you're out for 100 games. Well, the season's 160, so believe it or not, that's still not a full season, but it's more than half the season. I think A-Rod Alexander Rodriguez last year or the year before, it was his second one. I think it was technically his third one, but he got away on one of them. And he was out for the 100 games, and it went from one season to the next. That was a long one. And of course, he was like, oh, I'm going to sue, and this is, he's got some excuse for it. And then the lawsuit quietly went away, and he did his time. So Mark McGwire, A-Rod, Barry Bonds, of course, Roger Clemens, these are some of the biggest names who everyone knows did PEDs. Those guys are not going to the Hall of Fame. And like with Mark McGwire, I think he's only got a couple more years now of eligibility. And within a couple of years, that will be it. He never goes. And that's the way it should be. And this is how you change, and this is how you get rid of a nasty era. Baseball has done this very well. In terms of how the game is managed by the highest levels, you have to say baseball is managed very well. Maybe one of the best of any league. Although, admittedly, it changes. 20 years ago, everyone was ragging on baseball. Right now, people are ragging on football a little bit for a couple of different reasons. It does change with the weather. But baseball is so traditional. So many different kinds of people, ages of people, like baseball. It is a very international game. Thank goodness it's well managed. Honestly, it's the opposite of soccer. It really is. All right, I'm going to resist talking about soccer. Begin with the end in mind. That was one of the repeated lines from one of the speakers, one of the inductees yesterday into the Football Hall of Fame. I was aware it was going to be on. I think they're allowed 5 minutes to talk, right? So it's scheduled for a couple of hours. And the first couple went by, and I think I had it on mute, or I was napping, or I was finishing a nap or something. And so, you're looking at him, and you're aware of it. And then Aeneas Williams, it was his turn. And you want to see a guy take control of the microphone, in a good way. This was the guy. Right off the bat, he had your attention. He never let it go. I think he talked for about half an hour. I know for sure at one point he mentioned that he had talked for 20 minutes and he was going to be finishing things up, and he sure didn't finish things up anytime soon. Begin with the end in mind. There's so much in that sentence. Yeah, I'm talking about a quote of the week at the start. But it's about beginning. It's about beginning something with the end or end result in mind. Have it in mind. What are you trying to achieve in the end? What am I trying to achieve in a Floodcast in the end? The quotes, the quote of the week, that's kind of what I'm trying to achieve. Trying to give you something to think about. If you had to summarize a Floodcast in one thing, it would be something to think about. I was listening to someone else's podcast a few days ago, and they had a very slick intro, a lot of music, different kinds of music. It's a music industry person's cast, but they were like featuring AC/DC and various things. In that sense, my Floodcast is more like 60 minutes, right? There's no theme music for 60 minutes. Luckily, I don't give you a tick, 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 which is kind of annoying. Every cast has its flavor. A lot of them let you know pretty quickly. With some of them, I hear loud voices. They start off loud. I think that's kind of insulting. With some, they start off formulaic. You know, arguably I do. I always tell you the number and the date and all that stuff. But I want to bookend each one because when you're trying to catalog these things, say you save them and for some reason you don't save them with the full name. When I have them on my website, I have it like the Floydcast and then the number and then the date all in the name of the file. Because otherwise, you know, you just get these random files. Some guys name them by what they were talking about. I'm thinking of one podcast in particular where the guy names each podcast with what he was talking about. But it's not alphabetical at all. Like, I mean, what I mean is it's not chronological. So it might be good to give you a category sort of your MP3 files, but when you're listening to them, you're not going by category, I don't think. You're going by the date. When did you download them? Because without exception, everybody's podcast, you know, there's some degree of current events in there. You don't want to be listening to something that's 5 years old, talking about something that is not going to happen or already happened a long time ago or, you know, has been superseded in some way. It's just fascinating how things are presented, how information is presented. I've always, you know, taken quite a bit of pride in how I present my trivia. I call it Miss 9, Miss for miscellaneous. Trivia is like miscellaneous, but miscellaneous is a little different from trivia. Trivia is a subset. Trivia is like miscellaneous that doesn't matter. With my Miss 9, it's miscellaneous, but I try and make at least some of it matter. Yeah, there's a mixture. There's always some that are, it's like eating a pretzel. There's not a lot of nutrition in a pretzel. I always have a few of those in there. And lately, when I've been adding those, I, just for the first time, this is like after 20 years of doing this, I started putting some humor with the pretzel. So, we'll see how that goes across. I'll probably get some nasty emails. Begin with the end in mind. I gotta say, as a phrase from a talk, that one's in my top 10 already. He had one other thought. And as I've been preparing for this Floydcast, I've been hesitating. Should I say it now? It's really meant to bookend it. It's meant to be the other thought at the other end. And so I'm trying to force myself to wait till I get to the other end. When Aeneas Williams was playing, he played for the Cardinals, Arizona Cardinals, and the Rams. LA Rams? Boy, I've forgotten who the Rams, where their city is. I followed the Rams for a bit. At the point where they won the Super Bowl, I'm trying to remember, Kurt Warner, exciting quarterback. Falk was a great runner. And then Aeneas Williams on defense. They were an exciting team at that period of time. And Aeneas Williams is one of these guys that stands out. The name stands out. He's sort of unforgettable. What he reminds me of, because I think he plays a similar position, Troy Polamalu, who plays for Pittsburgh. Troy definitely plays a middle linebacker. The core, the central, like the quarterback of the defense. Troy Polamalu is like Derek Jeter, a guy who routinely does plays that go above and beyond the call of duty. There's one play that Derek Jeter did in a World Series game where the throw was from the outfield, the player is running to the plate, the throw went over the cutoff person. It's going to be short getting to the plate. The runner's going to score. Derek Jeter anticipated all of this and put himself right where the ball was going to end up. He just ran probably 100 feet out of position to be where the ball was going to be, when he needed to be there. He's running, and the ball is coming from his 90-degree left. He's got to catch it on the full run and throw it to his 90-degree right. Worth looking at YouTube for this if you don't know what I mean. I mean, honestly, probably many sports people know exactly what this play is because the announcer, among other things, the announcer said, Derek Jeter in one of the greatest plays in sports history kind of thing. It was that good a play. Maybe the greatest play I've ever seen in baseball. And you know, there's a lot of great plays in baseball. Baseball to me is a bit like basketball. There are certain categories of play and you see a lot of them. The guy hits the line drive, and the third baseman, the shortstop, the second baseman, they dive and catch it. That's one big category of baseball plays. Another one is he throws the ball laser-like, and the guy catches it, and the runner's out. And, of course, the third one is probably hitting a home run. You know, basketball has slam dunks, and it has, you know, maybe a move where you make the defenseman look a little bad, you know, or a hot-dogging play. Well, the point is that those plays come up a lot in those two sports because that's how the game is structured. So in other words, it's just the statistical. Oh, the long shot in basketball. That would be like the home run. The guy shoots from center field with 1 second to go on the clock. There goes the horn. He scores. Well, that's just statistical. One time they were doing a video of LeBron, sort of a, it wasn't during a game, it was during a practice. He was almost the entire length of the court away from the basket, and he was sinking baskets. At the time, when I was watching it, someone said it might have been rigged. I don't know if it was or not. Knowing LeBron and his athleticism, and these guys in general, it's not unreasonable to think these guys could sink two or three from almost full court in a row. So the point is, you can feature that as a top play if you want to, but it's not going to be all that memorable to shoot from half court and make it. I mean, after all, there are guys who, you know, they have halftime entertainment, and some nobody from the stands comes out and he gets one shot from half court, and if he makes it, he wins a car type thing. Well, periodically, these guys win a car. They're clearly nobodies. They're not warmed up. It's a nice throwing style or whatever, at least something to be desired. Periodically, someone's going to make it. If you have 10 or 15 games playing, basketball games or baseball games, you're going to have some great plays just statistically. So it's the exceptional play, the play that no one else thought of. That's the play that's the really great play that brings out the genius of the individual. Derek Jeter on that one World Series play, if you saw no other play that he ever did, and this Derek Jeter was famous for all kinds of great plays. Derek Jeter was sort of a mixture of, he's still playing, but this is his last year, by the way. He's a mixture of Mr. Reliable, Mr. Likeable, Mr. More Than Good Enough in everything he does. He's a mixture of that and Mr. Exceptional. We remember the exceptional, but the Mr. Better Than Average is what pays the bills. I mean, Derek Jeter will routinely run right into the stands to catch a fly ball. You know, when in baseball, a fly ball is a ball hit in the air. If you catch it in the air, the runner's out. It doesn't matter where you catch it. If you can reach it and catch it before it hits the ground, the batter is out. Well, Derek is just famous for launching himself into the seats to catch these balls. A lot of players, you might think they all do that. No, a lot of players, they're famous for running near the stands. There was a guy I saw this last week. Now, he was probably in the other team's ballpark. That's a disadvantage. You don't recognize where you are, so you don't have a good sort of spatial feel. It's like driving a big truck that you don't normally drive, right? You don't know where the endpoints of the truck are. So you're either cautious or you smash into things. Smashing, in this case, being your body, and you don't want to get injured. So, anyway, this guy pulled up 15 feet from the stands. 15 feet before the stands, he stopped running, and then the ball, plop, hit the ground because he stopped. Well, that's pretty common. There's probably one of those a week. So the guy who always goes the distance, always throws himself into the stands, that's amazing. And if I'm not mistaken, that Derek Jeter play, that great play, I think it was playing the Arizona Diamondbacks. I might be all wet on this. But it wouldn't surprise me if he made that play at an opposition ballpark. In other words, an unfamiliar ballpark. Anyway, so that's the great Derek Jeter. And Troy Polamalu reminds me of that. Troy Polamalu is the greatest defensive player I've ever seen. His level of anticipation alone makes him, he's like Lionel Messi. Lionel Messi is a wizard. Lionel Messi is a genius. Lionel Messi is captivating to watch. Troy Polamalu is captivating to watch. Literally, when he's lining up on that opposition, by the way, he moves around a lot. The defensive guys don't have to set. The offensive line has to set. They can't keep moving around. One of these many football rules. And so the defense can sort of be surprising you. Like, they sort of line up casually one way and you're set. And then they line up another way and now you got to adapt, right? And football, the offense can change. They can call an audible and then they can change. But when the ball is snapped, they have to be set. Whereas when the ball is snapped, the defense does not have to be set with their hand touching the ground. Well, Troy is just like a lithe cat, or you could say like a rabid dog. He's like an animal that's desperately, anxiously anticipating something that they're going to pounce on. And there have been cases where he is suddenly 3 yards behind the line of scrimmage. He's leapt 10 feet in the air and made the tackle before the play has even started. That's his level of anticipation. Just absolutely fantastic. Well, Aeneas Williams played in an earlier period of time. Troy was probably playing then, but he might not have had such long hair. You know, great players, they just stand out, and they're a real treat. I think of Jerry Rice. Jerry Rice was probably one of the first great players in my mind for NFL. in Canada, I was forced to watch Canadian football. I had a few Canadian players first, but I would say in the NFL, in the my early watching years, Jerry Rice was the man. I was a big early fan of that guy. Once I heard his off-season regimen, his training regimen in the off-season, most people in many sports, no matter what they do during the season, it used to be that in the off-season you didn't train. You didn't do anything. You drank beer or you played golf, you know. Jerry Rice changed that. And Jerry Rice proceeded to be, he was kind of like Wayne Gretzky, a guy who's just so far ahead of everybody else that, first of all, everyone knows the guy. The guy becomes immediately by everybody regarded as one of the greatest ever in each sport. And they just change how the whole thing is done. Gretzky begat Crosby, Sidney Crosby is the current great one. You know, Jerry Rice begat Troy Polamalu and also Aeneas Williams. Well, part of what I wanted to say in watching these guys, so then Aeneas went up, and after Aeneas, Trey Wingo, who's one of the ESPN analysts for football, and he does a great job, by the way. He's a host and analyst. Used to be just an announcer for ESPN, like doing the SportsCenter thing, but then he got put into the football role. ESPN has been making changes, probably as they expand, where some players sort of become known for now for certain sports. Some exclusively for certain sports, some known for two or three sports, and some are announcers and some are a mix, you know. Trey Wingo has really done a great job of being the host of one of the football shows, and there are, in the off-season of football, there are at least two football shows on ESPN. That's daily football shows when there's no football on. I gotta say, you know, when you get to the end of the Super Bowl, the withdrawals start pretty fast. And, you know, it's hard not to have a sad face when you think, oh, great, I gotta watch NFL Live, NFL Primetime, and NFL Live. I've gotta watch these shows every day, even when there's no football. That's just not gonna cut it. But, you know, it starts to cut it. And as the things sort of amp up, and you go through the NFL draft, which I talked about earlier, you go through now the NFL induction, Hall of Fame induction ceremonies, and we are just, I think we're a week away from football, the first preseason games. NFL ramps up really nicely, and there's just so much momentum, so much enjoyment by so many people, so much money put into it, that even in the off season, the NFL is, you know, it's a factor. Well, after Trey Wingo was said, as soon as Aeneas finished talking and they have to go to commercial, and Trey Wingo says, Aeneas should do a Hall of Fame speech every year. Very witty guy. Of course, that's funny and ludicrous because you can only do one of these. But Aeneas did one for the ages. No doubt about it. And then I was thinking, how do you follow that? The poor guys who schedule these things, they must know that Aeneas can really talk. Real motivator, motivational speaker. Who's going to follow that? So the guy who followed him was Walter Jones. Seahawks frontline defensive leg tackle or something. Well, I immediately work out Walter Jones's numbers. By the way, Aeneas, who was super expressive, let's look at his name. A-E-N-E-A-S. Unusual spelling of Aeneas. I mean, Aeneas is unusual, but then the way it's spelled is unusual. Well, anyway, it's a 369. The 369 is one of the most expressive numbers there is. The 3 wants to express, it wants to inspire others. The 9 really wants to do all of that. It's like times 3. The 9 adds power to what it's with, so it adds power to that 3 wanting to inspire. So 369 is a truly inspirational combination. And depending on what it's with, it can be quite good. Well, let's look at Aeneas Williams' last name, Williams. Williams 178. The 1 is that strong, that physical number. The 8 is successful in this particular combination. So you're successful at being physical and strong with a Williams name. Of course, Serena Williams, the football player like tennis player, demonstrates that, doesn't it? But there are lots of Williamses that demonstrate, lots of 178s that demonstrate that physical power. Ray Lewis, who used to play for Baltimore Ravens, Ray 178, same as Williams. And there was no one would ever argue how powerful and strong Ray Lewis was. A different Ray was in the news last week, Ray Rice. And by the way, Rice is also a very strong name. So Ray Rice has a double shot. So very, very strong numbers in his name, about as strong as they get. And then a 7 destiny. So Ray Rice is a misunderstood guy. Well, he hasn't helped this past week or two. I guess there was footage from some security cam, I think, Bottom line, it shows a domestic dispute in public. It appears that something happened to his wife while he and his wife were in an elevator. And Ray Rice has never talked about it, but it seems safe to say that he did something to his wife that appeared to knock her out. We don't know what she did to him, if anything. He has never wanted to talk about it. It's a black mark. Not a good thing in any way, shape, or form. It's unfortunate. But it's interesting that he's got strong numbers, not very expressive numbers in either name. Ray, 178-1, it doesn't have good expression. Rice, 538-5. You know, sort of can have a temper in its own way. The 1 and the 5 can both have tempers. And then his total, 617-7 destiny, the 7 is bottled up. They just want to be by themselves. Well, women tend to be more expressive than men. So you can imagine this guy who's very powerful and kind of bottled up. I'm not justifying anything, but you can imagine with his unbalanced names, Ray Rice, they're not balanced names, not recommended. You can just sort of imagine this man of power occasionally demonstrating physical temper, or verbal temper, certainly. Anyway, that was unfortunate this last week, but it's an example of that 178. So, Aeneas Williams, Williams 178, super powerful. And then with the first name, Aeneas 369, 369, 178, 448, 8 destiny. So he's got a successful destiny, successful last name. 448, the 4 is the muscles. Well, in football or soccer, you need those muscles, or baseball for that matter. Aeneas Williams, you can see why he's a good speaker. You can see why he's, you know, so committed. You can just see it all in the numbers. And I guess he's my good numbers combination of the week. What a talk he gave. So anyway, so following him was Walter Jones. As soon as I hear that, I go, Walter 617 with Jones 279, which is, you know, it can be emotional, but it can also be kind of soft. Soft in the sense of what's everyone else doing kind of thing, influenced by others. And then the total, 887, 7 destiny. Well, mathematically, basically, this guy was the opposite of Aeneas Williams. He stood up, and he did a good job. And part of what made it a good job that Walter Jones did was he ran through all the people in his life that had influenced him, that he was appreciative for, and he thanked them. And he thanked them in a way that if I was any one of those people, it would be like someone pounded you in the back 3 times really hard. You know, give you a bear hug. Thank you. Say so-and-so's name, my mom, who's done this, that, and the other thing for me. Thank you. And, but not even, maybe that tone is slightly different. Thank you. You know, like it was meaningful. Yeah, only 2 words, but meaningful. And then I sort of had to smile to myself. Like, I was thinking, how is this guy going to possibly compete? Or, you know, Aeneas Williams is a hard act to follow. But he did it by simplicity. Thank you can work, and work well, if you mean it. And then it shows, like, another facet of football. Football has these truly great players who inspire us all. But it also has these dedicated but humble players you don't even normally think about till that Hall of Fame rolls around and they're like, yeah, this guy's got to go, man. He was amazing. There were many good moments in that NFL Hall of Fame induction ceremony. This Jim Kelly fighting cancer. You know, I talked about Jim Kelly some Floydcasts ago and saying how basically he's got some bad numbers there. Bad in the sense of not healthy. Numbers that sort of drive you. And you know what happens sometimes is you paint yourself into a corner. It's like I was talking about Doc Rivers last week, the basketball coach for the Clippers, who's now painted into a corner. He says he won't work for Donald Sterling. Donald Sterling is not leaving. There's a legal process, so he doesn't have to leave right away. And Doc Rivers is sort of getting painted into the corner of, hey, well, you said you weren't going to play under this guy. What are you going to do? And, of course, Doc Rivers is very five-ish, first name and last name, and even as Glenn, he's born Glenn. He's got fives all over the place. When the five gives their word, they want to stick to it. Well, let's just give a word to the wise for the five-ish types in this world, of which almost everyone has a five somewhere. The odds of a given person having a five in their name somewhere is 2/3. And then, if you count the birthday, the average person has at least 1 5. Well, the trick of the five, they don't want to commit and then not follow through. And it frequently, you know, it bites them. Because other people change, and conditions change, circumstances change, promises change. The other person goes back on their word. Well, technically, at that point, your contract's broken. It's hard for the five. That's what makes the five sort of much more honorable than just about every other number. That commitment to their word. It's like with my Q9, my quotes, thoughts, and inspiration that I publish, and I published for 16 years. You know, I give my commitment to that publication. I don't go, well, I'll publish it whenever I feel like it. I'll publish it when the weather's rainy, and when it's a sunny day, I'm going to go to the beach. I publish it when I travel. I publish it on holidays, because to me, holidays, it's all relative. Holiday X in this culture might be important, and in that culture, it's not. Canada and the U.S. are very similar. The people, the culture, the market, it's all very similar. There are significant differences, and that's why I don't live in Canada at the moment. But one of the differences is, in Canada, December 25th, Christmas, is a big deal. And in the States, it's Thanksgiving. You know, it's just a difference. So if I made a big deal about Christmas in my Q9 or wherever, you don't necessarily turn off other markets, but you're not sort of being, considering them. As it happens, I occasionally publish something around Christmas time that's slightly Christmassy. Considering I publish every weekday, 22 days in a month, I get 22 chances in December to publish something to do with Christmas. But there are a lot of other days and holidays. 4th of July. Let's say your country is currently being attacked or negatively influenced by the U.S. I'm guessing that you don't celebrate the 4th of July. So you have to be respectful of that. And part of my respect for that is just to try and be consistent. I just crank them out every day, don't care what day it is. Also, on that day off, sometimes, you get more bored. I do. Christmas time especially. Things just kind of shut down. You get It's a Wonderful Life 26 times on one channel in one day. Luckily, you get Elf 26 times on one channel on one day, too. But the news sort of runs dry, and the buses are on a holiday schedule. Life is on a holiday schedule. So I don't want to let down. I want, maybe you're going through your emails and getting caught up. Maybe you want to think about something a little deeper than the average. In holidays, it's not exactly a deep time. Is there a holiday that is a deep thinking time? I know there are some holidays that probably think they are deep thinking, but I don't think there are too many. Really good deep thinking happens because you want to think about a subject, because you are dedicating some sort of internal resources to that subject. You're committing yourself to a subject, and then you work at it, and you work at it, and you work at it. And occasionally, you'll get a deep thought, a meaningful deep thought about that subject. It's really hard. George Bernard Shaw, famous writer, lived 100 years, vegetarian. He made a point of saying that basically coming up with a truly original thought is really difficult, and that he's made a good living by coming up with 2 or 3 good thoughts in a week. That's really something to think about there. Deep thoughts and precious thoughts, they're few and far between. Begin with the end in mind. He had the crowd saying it at one point. There's a great deal in that phrase. I really like that phrase because it speaks to intent. What is one's intent? When you go to YouTube, what's the intent? I think you could safely say, if you had to use one word, YouTube is trying to be entertaining. But that doesn't really define it fully. You could say a gun's intent is to, it's to kill, right? Let's say you have a gun for safety. You could say your intent is safety, but there can be a mishap. A young child can get a hold of that gun. They know where the bullets are or whatever. And some people with a gun, it makes them a little crazy, a little egotistical, a little powerful, trigger happy. With some people, a gun is a way to make some money, stealing. Intent is very, very important in everything we do. I have to thank some close friends from my background that I haven't seen in a while. They live in a different part of the world right now, but they really spoke about intent and conveyed it in how they live their lives. Some numbers are better with intent than others. The one quality I would say is the king of the intent hill. Well, Aeneas Williams, last name 178, that's the one expressing successfully, confidently, consistently through the 8. So on the higher side, his last name is that beginning with the end in mind, brought to life. And it shows. It really shows. And I just realized that it was like that phrase, I'm actually going to have a hard time getting that phrase out of my head. That's how good it is. All right, let's just move on. I'll just force myself to move on. But football's coming. All right, there was a story, an unhealthy glow. The story is from cancer.org. Illinois will soon become one of the first states to adopt a total ban on indoor tanning for everyone under age 18. Tanning booths deliver 10 to 15 times the UV of natural sunlight, boosting the user's risk of developing deadly melanoma by at least 75%. I remind teens and parents that 15 to 30 minutes in the booth equals a whole afternoon by the pool, says dermatologist Sean Burke, MD, one of hundreds of medical partners. I'm just working out his name. Sorry, I'm going to tell you his name, Sean Burke. Okay, Sean, 663. So it's nice of this guy to care and to talk to people and to tell them about skin problems, right? Problems that they're causing to themselves. Burke, 843. And he's a 516, 6 destiny. You know, it just shows, right? The 6 cares about others, and it's like the mothers and fathers of the world. Here's this doctor being parental. You know, a lot of doctors, they're not parental. They want to sell you something. They want to get you on a med. They want to make money from you. They're not into prevention. This guy's clearly into prevention. A 2010 study by the American Cancer Society showed that frequent users of tanning beds, and that's defined as those who tan for at least 50 hours, I think that's in total, or for 100 sessions in total for your whole life, or for 10 years, are 2 to 3 times likelier to develop melanoma than those who never tan indoors. One of my uncles, he had a very noticeable melanoma on his arm, and this is more than 10 years ago. But I just remember, and this is really true to our family, he was 85 to 90. Let's say he was 80. He was like, that's fine, I'm not going to do anything. Why do you have to do anything when you're 80 about a melanoma on your arm? Now, the only thing I can think of is, if there's pain involved, you want to manage pain, right? So you either want to avoid pain, or you want to take something for the pain. In other words, if your cancer starts to make things hurt, well, if you have to take some kind of medication, that seems reasonable. But if you haven't done the important things in your life at age 80, brother, it's too late. Don't start now. The point about this, the reason why I sort of have this story here, I'm talking about it is, I mean, imagine a state is going to ban them for those people under age 18. Because, you know, the problem with teenagers is they start to worry about how they look a lot, some more than others. And they get addicted. They get addicted to certain things. They have a more addictive personality. And tanning can be one of those things that you can get addicted to. I know someone when I go part of my weekly rounds. I routinely see this person who works somewhere. I'm trying not to say too much specifically, but they tan. And unfortunately, it's going to cost them. This person's younger than me, but they're going to be paying for that tan. There's going to be a second invoice later on. Is it worth it? On a scale of 1 to 100, for me personally, a tan is worth about 1 out of 100. Anyway, what I realized is it's a toxic thing, so I consider that a toxic update. In a second toxic update I've got, the headline says, Deadly Pain Pills, the very latest Consumer Reports, September 2014 issue. And they're talking about, you know, various prescription and over-the-counter medications that get abused, that people suffer from. But there was one that was way bigger of a problem than all the rest put together, honestly. If you recall, I talked about how there was a story, hey, guess what? 86,000 people a year die from drinking. Yeah, well, we know that, right? Why are they only talking about it once a year? Well, it turns out, according to Consumer Reports' latest issue, 80,000 people, basically the same number per year, in this case, are treated in hospitals for an overdose of acetaminophen. In my toxic document, I talk about acetaminophen, and if you follow the recommendations, they say a dose is 1,000 milligrams, it says it right on Wikipedia, and then they say you can take it 4 times a day. That's 4,000 milligrams, or 4 grams of this stuff. Well, it turns out if you take 6 grams, 50% more than what would be considered totally normal for a doctor to tell you to take, you box your liver. Some people got liver failure. Well, it turns out, let me just read. I'll read some of the quotes from the article. Acetaminophen is now the most common cause of liver failure. Boy, can I believe that. Another quote. It also mentions that those taking prolonged high doses of it were more likely to have brain and kidney problems. Then they were making the point that it's in many different products. In other words, you get it thrown in whether you wanted it or not, whether you're aware of its impact or not. They say it's in, acetaminophen is in over 600 over-the-counter and prescription meds. And then something really insidious. Prescription acetaminophen, they've lowered the dose. Consumer Reports was recommending 325 milligrams, so instead of 1,000, 325. 325 is about a third. That's a significant lowering. Well, they've done this with prescription acetaminophen. So the doctors are covering their rear ends so they won't get sued, right? If you can believe this, over the counter, in other words, what thee and me can buy in a store, they haven't changed the dose recommendation. If you can believe that. Now, it used to be, and it's frankly obvious and can only be this way, it used to be that what you can get over the counter, which means that you can just buy off the counter, it's not really kind of a good term. Off the shelf, it should be called OTS. It should be a weaker dose than what you can get by prescription. That's the whole idea of it. There's some stuff you got to go through a doctor who approves it, and there's some stuff that you can just grab it off the shelf and use it because it's not as bad. Well, nowadays there's so much stuff on that shelf that you can just grab and put in your shopping basket that's not good for you. Well, acetaminophen, they haven't lowered the dose on the box that you can grab off the shelf. You know what this is? This is a class action lawsuit waiting to happen. A big one. So those changes should have been the other way around. It should have immediately on the shelf. They should have lowered the dose. Here's an example. Ibuprofen, the one I think, you know, of all the meds is, let's call it close to useful. Ibuprofen, when you buy it, like I'm thinking of Kroger or, you know, for us locally, that's like QFC or Fred Meyer. When you go in there and you buy the ibuprofen, 200 milligrams is the strength. Well, when you go to a doctor, say something, you know, you have an operation or some got major pain, you go to a doctor, they routinely prescribe 600 or 800 milligram per tablet. And I've had them prescribing 800 and saying, you know, take three or four of these a day. Doctors are routinely prescribing the maximum recommended amount of ibuprofen, sort of at the drop of a hat, honestly. But that's how the system is supposed to work. And in the store, it's weaker. It's 200. It's a lot weaker. It's kind of like the baby aspirin approach. People have gotten into this habit, some of them, of taking a baby aspirin. It's not really that great an idea, but a baby aspirin, I think, is like three times or four times weaker than a regular aspirin. So if we're going to do it ourselves, we have to take something that's a lot weaker, roughly, let's say, four times weaker. Well, they got this backwards with acetaminophen. So there, though, is Consumer Reports talking about it. Front page news in that magazine. That's nice to see. And it's also a nice bit of feedback to show that my document is pretty authoritative. It's pretty carefully calculated. And acetaminophen was one of the standouts, in a bad way, from my research for that document. And it's nice to see that Consumer Reports is stepping in and doing something themselves about it. I heartily agree with them. All right, back to sports. This is a baseball, a couple of them. Vin Scully has signed up with his team. His team's the Dodgers. He's an announcer. He announces for the LA Dodgers baseball team. Well, does he ever? He's 86 years young, and he signed up for his 66th year. He's already been an announcer for 65 years. That's unbelievable. Just imagine, how many people do you know that have worked any job for 50 years? I'll tell you, 50 years in itself is exceptional, because just do the math. Let's say you start at age 15. 15 plus 50 is 65. You retire. Most people retire at 65 or earlier. Most people don't start work at 15. So even to get to the 50-year mark is exceptional. 65 years. Vin Scully, to put it mildly, he ain't doing it for the money. Well, that's refreshing in this day and age. Let's look at his name. His full name, Vincent Edward Scully. Goes by Vin. So Vincent, 516. Okay, 516. It's 5 is sort of that active new thoughts combination. And a lot of announcers are 5-ish. You got to have a quick delivery in sports announcing. It really pays off. I'm thinking of especially of auto racing. I remember analyzing one guy, and half of his numbers, half of his 6 numbers were 5s. At least he might have even had 4 of them. He sort of had the maximum. All right. So, you know, Vincent's first name. And then the 6 again. We were just talking with someone who had a 516 total. Oh, it was that doctor in the 6th Destiny, and he was like helping people, right? Well, Vincent helps people. Part of his baseball job, he realizes, is he does something that people really like, and it makes them feel good, makes them feel happy, makes them jump up and clap their hands and dance. And they only do it once a week. They do it when they're watching that Dodgers baseball game, thanks in part to him. How about the last name, Scully? S-C-U-L-L-Y. 382. The 382 is a very likable combination. The 3 loves people, 3 wants to inspire people. as we've talked about earlier today. And then it expresses to the two. The two is an understanding quality. Hang on, Pete. When I sip pizza, most of the time I don't usually share my slurping with you, but I just want to say that I do enjoy it, and it fits perfectly into doing a podcast. I can see a lot of radio announcers drinking coffee. So Skelly 382, that's a quality that would love being around people. It would like being around sports. The three is a sporting quality, but it's the camaraderie and the inspiring and making, putting a smile on the guy's face, the person next to you, the little kid's face. That's what would really drive a Scully person. So Vincent, Scully, added together, 898 total, 8 destiny. Well, that's a super successful combination, but it's also a combination that's very competent, and they just become very good at what they do. They rise to the top. Without a doubt, Vince Scully has risen to the top of his profession. Well, there's still a little bit more to analyze. When you throw Edward in there, then he has a 549 total. There's quite a bit to work out with this guy because he's got a nickname. It seems like every baseball player has at least one nickname. Anyway, when you take all of this guy's names together, 549 total, 9 destiny. Well, the 9 says give. Give till it hurts. Give some more. Number of service. Well, without a doubt, he's doing this. And this is why this guy is alive. This is why this guy is, you know, successful. His name has forced him to be giving, and he's found a way to give and yet be paid. There's one other combination to analyze. That's his nickname, Vin, V-I-N. Well, V-I-N is a 999. We've talked about that before. It can be the number of losses. It's also the number of giving. Giving to the maximum, we'll call it. As I've written down, give till it hurts and give some more. And that's what he does. I'm sure he's not without pain these days at age 86. Imagine, this guy's 30 years older than me. I feel young. From Wikipedia, one more thing to share. Scully has endured a pair of personal tragedies in his life. In 1972, his 35-year-old wife, Joan Crawford, died of an accidental medical overdose. Scully was suddenly a widowed father of three after 15 years of marriage. Now that is a tragedy no one's expecting. 35-year-old wife? So this happened 28, 38, 42 years ago. In late 1973, he married Sandra Hunt. By the way, Hunt, 369. Vin, 999. We talk about his 9 destiny, so he married someone who... Oh, and Sandra, 213, and Scully, 382. They married each other's combinations. There's strong similarities in their names. Anyway, she had 2 children of her own. They soon had a child together. Scully's eldest son, Michael, died in a helicopter crash at the age of 33 while working for a company. So once again, he had someone probably younger than him. I'm working it out. When in 1972, when his wife died, she was younger than him. But the double pain of losing one of your children at a young age, that's something that I remember. I think it was Bill Cosby talking about it, how painful it is to lose, you know, someone younger than you that you've brought into this world and you've given everything to. You nurture them like a tree, right? And they grow and they're growing and they're doing great. And you're the tree that's about to become firewood. And then something happens to their tree. That's a sad moment. Well, he's going to attract more than his share of that with that name. That's what it says. With Vin 999 and with, he was born with a 9 destiny. He's going to attract that. You know, for comparison, just with myself and my relatives, I know of no case of anyone where the young person died before older family members, even older siblings. They died from the oldest to the youngest kind of thing. I think almost without exception, you know, I feel lucky for that. So, Mr. Scully signed up again with the Dodgers. Let's give a little shout out to Mr. Scully, who has dedicated his life to service to others. Good on you. By the way, a little bit of trivia. Yasiel Puig, who I've featured, he plays for the Dodgers. Okay, this one is Sam Fuld, F-U-L-D. Guy, I've never even heard his name before. His names, they don't have an accident in there, they don't have a 5 in there. And he has a 494 total. It's not a particularly successful total, which probably explains why I haven't heard of him before. Hang on, Pete's again. Well, as watching baseball highlights, I do watch some involuntarily when I watch Keith Olbermann. I just find baseball to be less interesting in general to watch, with the only exception being, you know, World Series, where the cream has risen to the top and people are giving their maximum and the game actually starts to become a bit interesting. Anyway, Olbermann was showing highlights on one of them. Sam Fuld is fielding the ball in the outfield, and he's going to throw it to the plate. That's a long throw. You have to be, you know, really good to do that. And not everyone can do that. It's more common to throw it to a cutoff man. Well, he fielded the ball. He threw it to the plate as hard as he could. So hard, he threw his body forward and had to do a forward roll. I thought that was awesome. Let's look at his name. Sam, 156. The one is certainly physical. Fold, F-U-L-D, 347. 494 total. Four is the muscles. We've talked about the muscle total, the muscle combination. Well, this guy's got the 494 total. This guy is a bundle of muscles. Enough muscles that just by the action of throwing the ball, he threw himself forward so hard he had to roll. Good effort. If I was the coach, I would show his highlight of him doing that once a week to the players and say, this is what I'm looking for. This level of effort. Hey, run the fold clip again, Frank. That's what we're looking for. By the way, it's come to my attention that last week when the moth was flying around, the audio that I left in the Floydcast so that you could hear and experience my moth invasion was loud. Someone said it was loud. And they're right. Normally with those loud sounds, I'll sort of mute them down a little bit. But honestly, I left it the way it was. You know, my original intent was that this thing, it just suddenly appears. It's enormous. It starts banging against the lampshade here, and it is loud. You know, if I was a type to be startled, I would be startled. There was a basketball injury. The U.S. basketball team was playing a friendly, an off-season game, sort of getting ready, slow work up to the Olympics next year. Paul George got a massive ankle injury. Kind of horrific, you know, one of those ones that can be a career ender or can certainly take like a year to recover from. What was interesting was I worked out his names and there wasn't any 775, wasn't any 527, although admittedly he had one of each, but they were not in the same combination. And you know, I worked out his name and his numbers, his birthday, and his cycle. Here's what I got as to why this happened. I think this, first of all, there's an obvious physical reason why it happened, and that is that in the international basketball rules system, the basketball backboard base is closer to the field of play than in the NBA. And that's how he injured himself. He landed against the unmovable backboard material and bent his ankle very badly. So first of all, that's something that's going to be changed. I'm sure it will be changed. This won't happen to others. So it was kind of a fluke. Admittedly, it is a kind of an accident looking for a place to happen kind of injury. Paul George, Paul, 415. The 4 and the 5 together is discordant. I don't want to pick on him. I don't want to pick on his combinations. He has an 8 destiny. You know, he has some offsetting numbers in his makeup. But a 415 is not healthy. The numbers are at odds with each other. You don't want a 415. You don't want a 4 in your name. You don't want a 5 in your name. You sure don't want them together. Because when one is happy, the other isn't. The 4 wants stability. The 5 wants change. The 4 wants to work with people sort of systematically and patiently and carefully. The 5 wants freedom. Get out on the highway on that motorcycle with the chopper. Got a dog dreaming. We'll let it run its course. Still see some twitching. I think that's it. So, I would say a mild factor in Paul George's injury is the first name that it is. You know, the 5's an accident number. He does have it in the first name. He has a discordant first name. Last name is not really injury prone, 753. It's not really like that at all. His total, his destiny is not like that. Let's look at his birthday. Born on May 2nd, 1990. Well, he's under the May influence, which is a 5. So he's a 521 for an 8 in the birthday, and he's an 8 under a 5 right now. So he is a little bit more 5-ish in the birthday, and that lines up with the 5 in his first name, right? So he is, you know, a little bit of that excellent quality, not a lot. He's in his 6th year, 7-4 months. Well, he just came into that 7-4 month. Now the 4 is test. He just came into a test month. The day was not testy. He worked with the letters under his name. They were fine. I think what happened in this case was it's his fault for putting a little bit too much into the game, which isn't a bad thing, right? Derek Jeter. It's kind of, what he did was Derek Jeter-esque. And he just had a name that maybe was 5-ish enough that he got burned. He got kind of ripped off for his commitment to the game. One other thing, he plays for the Indianapolis Pacers. Indianapolis, Indiana, is fluoridated, and fluoride weakens bones. It erodes bones. When you take it regularly, and of course nowadays we get fluoride from many, many sources, causes fluorosis. It literally will dissolve your bones. When you look at people that have extreme fluorosis, I've seen pictures where the bone is just, it's almost not recognizable as a bone. Well, you can safely predict from that people who are drinking fluoridated water or consuming a lot of fluoride, they're going to be more likely to break their limbs. I would love to know a statistical analysis of bone breaks by parts of the country. That's where, you know, they keep all that data hidden from us because we could draw our own conclusions pretty easily from it. Too bad that it happened. Everyone feels bad for Paul George, but this one doesn't quite fit the mold of the accident looking for a place to happen. This fits the mold of, I would say, like four different factors working together. It's time for the of the weeks. First one, bad driver of the week. Well, I think I'll just summarize this with a three-word phrase, cell phone lunatics. In this past week, I saw more incidents, not just where people are using a cell phone where it's obvious. You know, something that's been common is when you're at a traffic light, the person in front of you, the light turns green, they don't move. They're checking their phone at the light, right? And you know, if you have to choose a place to do something that you don't need to do, that could annoy others, that's potentially dangerous, it's kind of stupid if you analyze it. Checking your phone at a traffic light is somewhat harmless. Well, this past week, I saw numerous incidents where people were checking their cell phone while they were driving, and they were looking down. Their head was physically pointed directly into their lap. They weren't putting their cell phone out in front of them towards the steering wheel so that they were at least looking with a down angle of, let's say, 45 degrees. Their down angle of their eyes was 90 degrees. They were 90 degrees away from watching the road. Quite boggling. And it wasn't one case. It's sort of in the you gotta be kidding me category. The situation's only gonna get worse before it gets better. Because how do you police it? If you're a policeman, if you see it, you give them a ticket, great. I don't give them a ticket. I don't really want Joe Citizen giving and snapping a phone picture with an application put out by the police. And it's snag a cell phone user application and you take a picture and it automatically gets uploaded and the police go, oh yeah, we can give him a ticket. I don't want that level of Big Brother and that level of using people against people on the one hand. But on the other hand, a driver who's driving down the road with their head staring at their groin is a dangerous driver, to say the least. It was amazing how frequently I saw this. All right, there was another one this past week. This one was both comical and at least as dangerous. I'm driving on a highway. I'm in the fast lane, which doesn't mean I'm going fast. I'm going, you know, microscopically faster than the other lane as I try and do either slightly faster or get out of the lane. And, you know, you're going between traffic lights. It's inner city. You know, the ring that runs around the city. It's ring driving. And there are lights every half mile or so. So it's not a big hurry. We're not going 70. We're going, you know, 55. And in front of me, in the fast lane, is a truck towing a truck. It's towing a trailer. It's towing a trailer that started life as a truck. Someone eventually cuts the truck in half. They keep the back half, and they turn that into a trailer. Well, he's on the way to the dump, by the way, as it turns out. And that happened to be very close to where I was going. The store I was going to was very close to that direction. At highway speed, his trailer had a resonance issue. Quickest way to explain this, Tacoma Narrows Bridge, the bridge that came down in a high wind, it had a resonance issue. The wind, I think it was like 70 miles an hour, was enough to make the bridge sway in a rhythmic fashion. Another example of resonance is when you're on a swing and you make yourself go higher. You do it by adding energy at exactly the right time. Making that swing go higher is a positive use of resonance. Tacoma Narrows Bridge is a negative use of resonance. This truck driving down the highway with his trailer wallowing in a way I have never seen. The movement of this trailer from one side to the other, if you had a measuring tape and you measured part of the back of the truck, the distance it was covering from one side to the other was about 4 feet. Now, to give you a comparison, normally your trailer shouldn't move at all. If you go over a bad bump, your trailer might move 6 inches up and then come back down. Let's say a total range after a bump that you drove over too fast, total range of 1 foot. Top gear, you're racing around a track and you throw your car over. You start to hit the limits of a car, right? Well, this guy was hitting the limits of what this trailer, any vehicle, could do. He was hitting it as he was driving in a straight line. Was this guy not using his mirrors? What was he doing in the fast lane? These are some of my questions. There's a secondary road off to the left that goes right to that same dump. It's a well-known back road in that area. Why wasn't he on that going 30 miles an hour instead of 50? You know, sure enough, when he slowed down, we both pulled off. And as I was going a couple more blocks to my store and he was going on to the dump, he wasn't wallowing at 20 miles an hour or 30. How careless can you be that you're not looking at your trailer when you're driving? I honestly cannot imagine that. But here's a question to my one listener. Okay, I think I might have two. Myself and my one listener. Yeah, that's two. Do you ever look at your load? I mean, you're supposed to. This is part of driving 101. You know, this is the basics of driving. This was so bad, I wanted to call 911. He could have just dumped that thing all over the road. What was interesting, sometimes when you have a really bad driver, you can share your frustration with other drivers, because I've had cases where you sort of look at the driver next to you as you're watching the guy up ahead do something crazy, and you shake your head at each other and sort of smile like, crazy guy, what's he doing, you know? Glad it's not me. Well, I deliberately drove next to a guy on my right. We were both following behind this wallowing trailer, and they had no expression and no response. They weren't talking about it. They weren't shaking their heads. They weren't smiling. They weren't laughing. They weren't angry. They weren't doing anything. It didn't bother them. I find that kind of amazing. You know, if we don't get involved in our lives, at least at the extremes, at least get involved when things are getting really dangerous, when do we get involved? All right, don't have a re-listen of the week. I think I worked a lot this week, sort of had a lot of projects and whatnot. My reread of the week. I was working on trivia this week. A friend of the family had kindly been cutting out trivia from the comics, the newspaper comics. They'd done this for a long time, and I'd saved them up for a long time, and I got them all typed in. All the little bits of trivia that I thought were interesting. And I bought a calendar 9 years ago, I bought a calendar, and it was 365 trivia items. I never used it as a calendar, you know, those page-a-day calendars, but it had 365 trivias. Well, I finally typed those and went through them. I had fun with it. That was one of the ones I was telling you were with the trivia now, with the pretzel trivia, and now added a little bit of humor to it. Well, I added some humor to some of those. Can't wait for the reaction. Nasty emails. So that was my read of the week. You know, it's fun to read trivia. You learn something. Makes you think. All right, my watch of the week. I had a watch and a rewatch. I rewatched Jim Gaffigan Obsessed. It's actually the first time I watched it, but it turned out it's one of his other comic routines rebranded. And I was kind of surprised by that. Gaffigan has been very consistent in coming up with new material. Beyond the Pale and King Me. He's had some really great material. Jim Gaffigan, I consider one of the top 10 comics, stand-up comics, for sure. Really a delight. Clean. Yeah, there's a bit of innuendo. You know, he uses the four-letter word that starts with D. But it's relatively mild compared to some. And just quite ingenious comedy. Well, anyway, Obsessed. Save your money if you're thinking of buying it. If you're collecting the whole set, you don't need this part of the set. He had already come up with this material, so that was my rewatch of the week. Watched that last night. Still makes me chuckle, and I've heard it many times. Okay, my watch of the week was actually from a couple weeks back. I got something from the library on DVD. It's called The Science of Measurement, Taking the Measure of the World. IMDb calls it Precision, the Measure of All Things. Two totally different titles. It's not uncommon for it to happen that way. What did I like about that so much? I'm not even sure. I guess measurement is a big deal for me, because with my spring loop theory, I say that, you know, speed of light is slowing down, the meter is changing in length, all these things are changing gradually, admittedly, for the speed of light to slow down 50%, it's going to take 100 billion years, so it's not slowing down a lot. But the cool thing is that with spring loop theory, I realize it's all tied together. Dark energy, that's space expanding. What's it coming from? Well, it's coming from the springs pushing against each other. Springs of energy, very high energy. That's why light is slowing down, is that light is the energy, the propagation through the energy, through the springs. You know, in croquet, you have a ball, and if the other ball settles next to it, you can put your foot on your ball and then hit the other ball in a bad direction. Well, that's that ping, right? That's how sound moves through a solid object, is one atom being struck, and then that energy strikes the next atom, and so on, and it propagates through the entire Earth in that manner. You have an earthquake on one side of the world, and it rings the world. It literally makes the world ring by transmitting that energy through that pinging of one molecule to another. Well, I say that the ether, there is an ether, the ether is energy, or I call them springs so that we can visualize it. All of life's springs, they're everywhere, they're super small. Smaller, 100 billion times smaller than the smallest parts of an atom. Super, super small. When something gets hit, it transmits through those spring collisions. This was well done, the science of measurement. I've honestly forgotten why I had it in here. Should have made at least one note about what made this such a good documentary. But it was good. All right, my cool thing of the week. I'll start with the uncool thing first. Turns out that they now figure that they have underestimated the effect of burning stuff in terms of contributing to worldwide pollution, as they call it. They now figure that when we burn what they call biomass, so that could be burning a field. Some countries, they burn a field to get it ready for the next crop. Even in the States, they burn. It's routine to burn land so that you get rid of the weeds, right? And then your grass grows again, type thing. Obviously, when you tear down a rainforest and you harvest some of the trees, they then burn what's left so that then they can turn it into crappy farmland. Well, they now figure that 5 to 10% of the worldwide air pollution, mortalities, pardon me, so it's not just air pollution, but they even get it down to, you know, the effect on people. 10% of the people who die from air pollution are dying from the air pollution caused by burning stuff. Not just cars or burning coal in a coal-fired energy generation plant, or trying to think of what other things cause pollution. I guess industrial processes like the fertilizer industry that makes fertilizer and also has a waste product of fluoride, which gets added to our drinking water, luckily for them. Anyway, burning stuff, big contributor to air pollution fatalities. Surprising, uncool, don't burn stuff. You know, that's one thing, it's people are going to create pollution. Don't kid yourself. And if you don't create it because you're alive, somebody's creating it, pollution for you, to get that product to you. So if you really care about the environment, you're going to cut down population. That's Floyd's Law. If you really care about the environment, don't make babies. All right, my cool thing of the week. Bounty towels. There's a new kind of Bounty brand towel. This one's called a Jura towel, so it's more durable. Well, let me tell you, Bounty towels are durable. That's one of the things I love about them. In our use here, and we use them a lot in this household, they almost never break down. I mean it. In every need that we have, we're not being ridiculous in our testing. We're not making a pad out of Bounty towels, tying it to a truck, and then driving around the neighborhood, sitting on it, see if we can wear them out. No. But in our usage around the house, they never fail. Here's an example. Say you have a spill. One thing that happens here a little too often is you'll kick the dog dish, the water dish, and then the water. Murphy's Law says that at least 80% of the water will come out of the dish when you tap it. Well, that can be like a quart of water. That's a lot of water. You can't pick it up with one or two towels. So you have a choice. You can use 20 towels, which is, in my mind, a waste of towels, or you can use like two or three. And then what I do is I have the two or three in my hand, I stick it down, I soak up a bunch, squeeze it out in the sink, go back, do it again. Two or three times, it only takes a minute. You get it all mopped up and you save some towels, but the thing doesn't fail. To the point where you can dry it out. Say that when we use a towel and we've only used it for water, a water usage, we sort of have a tiered use of our towels. In other words, you know, there's obviously uses where you want things to be clean and hygienic. And then there are uses where you're cleaning up a never-ending problem, let's put it that way. And so that's not a demanding use for a towel. It doesn't have to be clean to start because when you're finished, is not going to be clean. You're just sopping up something that regularly happens. Here's an example. In the sink, I'm the guy that does the dishes and whatnot, like loads the dishwasher and stuff. And so you get stuff out of the sink, and when you're done, you know, there's food garbage in the sink. I just don't like that. I like a clean sink once I've loaded the dishwasher. So I'll just take one of the towels that it's on its second use, and we've had it, you know, just kind of drying there, and I'll just wipe thoroughly around the sink. One of the things is in the sink is when you've had, you know, food debris there and whatnot, is some of it's oil. Oil and water don't mix. It won't flow down the drain by itself. It'll stick to your sink. So you take the paper towel, you move it around. Now the oil sticks to the towel really well. And now your sink doesn't have grease in it. That's a nice property. Well, it's not essential. It's a working sink. We don't have a spiffy show home. We're not interested in that. But so it's, you know, just an ongoing, you know, mop it up and keep going kind of thing. But it's a second use for that towel because it's such a good towel. Well, these Germa towels are like, they're cloth, they're billing them as being cloth-like. They're more sterile than a sterile towel kind of thing. They had a kind of a cute little video where they have these towels and they have a nice little clamp on, a special clamp that so that you don't, you know, if you hooked a towel around a hook, it would tear easy, right? Because all the force is on that one spot. But if you grab a towel in a distributed way, in other words, you grab it in 20 points at once, you spread the force over 20 points. Well, they had a clamp that was spreading it over, let's say, 20 or 30 points, so that's good. You get rid of what they call in engineering edge effects. So in this test, they got rid of edge effects. They had the competing brand, and they had the Bounty towel on like a clothesline thing clamped on the top. And they said, we're going to hang this weight. And they, you know, the weight, it was kind of dramatic, you know, it's so many gram weight. Well, bottom line is it's only a pound or two in a weight that's hanging from the bottom of this paper towel. Still, you know, you hang a weight from a piece of paper, how many pieces of paper can hold that? Well, they can hold it, a regular piece of paper can hold it, because it has very strong tensile strength. But a paper towel normally doesn't have that. Especially in the old days, they would, you know, no towel would pass it. So each of the towels is holding this one weight. And then he said, now let's wet the towel. Well, that's a totally different game. As soon as you wet paper, you weaken it dramatically. And in paper towels, they're designed to be absorbent. It's like toilet paper. Toilet paper is designed to be soft, but soft means short fibers in some cases. And as a result, they don't do the job that toilet paper needs to do. That's why I like Costco toilet paper. It's soft enough, but it's very durable by comparison to many other brands. Well, Bounty is like that in paper towels. It's soft, not that it has to be particularly soft, but it is. But most importantly, it's absorbent, which is a soft-like quality, but it's also strong. That magic combination. Well, so then they hang the weight on each of them, then they wet each of them, and of course, the no-name brand, the unmentioned brand, the competitor brand, immediately fails. The Bounty doesn't. And then they hang two more weights. They triple the weight on the Bounty towel, and it still doesn't fail. Okay, these tests can be rigged. I can think of ways that the tests could be rigged. Somewhat rigged, we'll put it that way. I think, you know, it's safe to say the Bounty towel is better than the other towel, but maybe not quite as much as the test might make it appear. But still, it was a fun commercial. I enjoyed it because I love Bounty towels. I absolutely love those towels. You know, it probably sounds ridiculous, but they're in my, you know, top 10 favorite products. They're such a great solution. I have my wife to thank. She's a towel user. I'm a cloth towel user. She's always been a paper towel user, and she's converted me to it. Bounty towels and my wife converted me to paper towels. My name is Floyd Maxwell, and I'm addicted to Bounty towels. Thank you. My quote of the week, and I finish up with a quote. Well, obviously, I started this whole talk with Aeneas Williams. Begin with the end in mind. So I had something in mind when I began today. I had a quote in mind because I cheated and I took Aeneas Williams' second quote. As mentioned, he had half the crowd saying, begin with the end in mind at the end of his talk. And then he had the other half of the crowd saying, die empty. When you die, be empty. Now, technically, I wouldn't, you know, if you want to be a stickler, you can't die completely empty because it actually takes energy to die well. I think of Mel Gibson and Braveheart dying, and it took energy for him to scream at the end. I'm not trying to give away the show. Spoiler alert. But it took energy for him to express his last word. Well, there's some of that in the act of passing away. You want to go away free. Free of earthly concerns. Free of guilt. Free of fear. Free of I wish I had regret. Free of anger. Just free. Peaceful. We are star stuff. We are stardust. And, you know, return back to those stars when you go. But this quote is talking about put it all out there in your life. Put it all out there on the field. Whatever you're doing, put it all out there. I've tried to put it all out in this floodcast. I can't read it. I have no idea how it will be perceived. But I've done my best. Do your best. Begin with the end in mind. Die empty. What a great talk that was. Worth getting to YouTube. I want to hear that periodically. It's one of those talks that you want to hear periodically. It's that good. This has been Floyd Maxwell, justthinkit.com, doing a Floydcast number 25 for August the 4th, 2014. Good luck with your life. Take care.